Tonight, five female scientists are being honored for their pioneering discoveries at the 7th Annual Women of Discovery Awards. And joining me now are three of them, wildlife biologist Abhirajita. I'm so sorry. You know, I really got your name right before. Abhirajita Datta of India, wildlife conservationist Leela Hazza of Egypt, and New York's own marine geophysicist Maya Tolstoy. Welcome to all of you, and congratulations for the award. Abhirajita, what's the discovery that you're being honored for?
In the way that, you know, the discovery was in terms of two new species that we found in these forests in India, in the northeastern part of India, I guess that would be considered a discovery. But I think it's for the larger work where I also work with communities to try to address some serious threats in that area. So I don't know whether it's for a particular discovery as such, but in terms of something sounding very exciting, it is probably the new species that we found in the area.
Well, looking over all of your work, there's that interaction. There's the scientific side, and then there is the dealing with the people who are in the area side. You found two species, new species of deer and also macaque monkeys?
Yeah.
Just coincidentally that you found the deer and the monkey? There's no relationship between the two?
No, there's no relationship. The monkey we found in another part of that area. The deer is actually, I need to correct that. The deer is not something that I found which is new. The monkey is new to science along with some other colleagues of mine. But the deer is already been discovered by Alan Rabinowitz, who works with WCS in New York, in the Myanmar forests. I just happened to find them in India, not a big deal.
Nobody knew that they were there.
Yeah, so for India, it's a big thing that there's another mammal added to the list, but it's just a range extension real terms. You know.
Now, how different from a similar species of macaque monkeys are these? What is it, Arunachal monkeys?
Yeah, it's called the Arunachal macaque, and very surprisingly, this part of the region which I'm talking about is very poorly populated. But this part is pretty developed in some ways. And when my colleagues and I went on the survey, we were driving down, and it has road network, unlike many other places in that region. And we were amazed to see this troop of macaques, which looked very dark and bulky, like gorillas almost, you know, the way they were walking. And we knew that there's another macaque that's supposed to be found in the area, and it did not look anything like that. So it was quite amazing that people had missed it.
And how genetically different are they from other macaques?
Genetically, my colleagues have done more further DNA analysis, and they're quite different. But they are related to the closest, the existing sympatric species, which is the Assamese macaque.
But they can't interbreed?
They possibly could be interbreeding, yeah.
Leela, tell us about the initiative for which you're being recognized.
The initiative that we're working on is a project called Lion Guardians. And basically, the situation in Kenya is very tough with lions. Lions are disappearing from one of their last strongholds at a very alarming rate. You know, about 50 years ago, we had 500,000 lions in all of Africa. And
these
now,
are the classic African lions?
These are the classic African lions, and now we have probably less than 29,000 left on the whole continent.
Wow.
And I think people don't really realize that. And the main cause for their decline is conflict with pastoralists, with livestock farmers. Carnivores eat people's livestock and people retaliate. And we're working in an area in southern Kenya called Masalent with the Maasai tribe, and they completely rely on livestock. Their livelihood is based around livestock, and when carnivores do eat their livestock, they have almost no choice but to retaliate. And so as a conservationist, we try to provide incentives and opportunities for them to engage in conservation. And Lion Guardians does that. It's a program that that tries to integrate and involve communities in conservation by working specifically with the age group called warriors. They're called Moran warriors, and they're the ones who are responsible for killing lions. And we take them on to the project and teach them about conservation. And now we have Morans across the ecosystem who are actually doing conservation and monitoring the lions instead of killing them.
Have lions always we're talking about the Maasai, who mostly herd cattle.
Of course.
Have they always been a danger to the livestock, or are they going after the livestock because other things that they would have fed on in the past are no longer around?
I guess it probably is a mixture of both. Maasai have always killed lions. It's been in their tradition. They had, especially the younger age set, they go on a manhood hunt when they're very young. And, you know, about 8 to 10 morons, they go out to kill a lion. And the first one to spear the lion is said to be given, their birth name is dropped, and they're given the name of the lion that they killed. And they're fawned by all the women in the community. And it's probably the most important day for a moron's life. And so the relationship between lions and Maasai are extremely close, but I think in the past there were just a lot more lions. And of course they did kill livestock, but it was maybe more sustainable back then, but now with such few lions, we're actually able to see the results.
You said there are 29,000 lions in
Less.
Kenya.
No, in all of Africa.
In all of Africa. Was Kenya the main repository?
East Africa and Southern Africa, about half of those 29,000 lions live in Tanzania. And we estimate about 2,000 lions live in Kenya, and about half of those 2,000 lions live in the southern part of Kenya where we work.
Maya, what about the research for which you're being awarded?
I work on mid-ocean ridges, which are the chain of seafloor volcanoes where all of the oceanic crust is formed. So it's where two-thirds of the surface of our planet forms. And I specifically work on the little micro-earthquakes that are constantly happening there and on the eruptions that occur on the seafloor.
And that's in the middle of the Atlantic?
There's one in the middle of the Atlantic. There's one on toward the center, but in the eastern part of the Pacific. There's one just off the coast of Oregon and Washington. There are mid-ocean ridges in all the major oceans in the world.
And it means that it's expanding the size of the oceans in every case?
The oceans are constantly spreading at these ridge sites. They're constantly moving apart, and then the crust is ultimately subducted. Again, it's subduction zones, so that the planet's not getting bigger, but new surface is constantly being formed.
How do the tidal cycles affect seismic activity underwater?
Well, one of the things that we've found with the little micro-earthquakes is that they're heavily influenced by the ocean tides. So the additional loading and unloading that you get with the water as the tides go up and down cause these little cracks to happen, preferentially when the stresses are greater for inducing cracks. But one of the most exciting things we're finding is that the micro-earthquakes actually are essential for fueling these very unusual hydrothermal ecosystems that live there. So there are creatures there that live chemosynthetically, so without sunlight. And it turns out that they're very dependent on earthquakes because the cracks that the earthquakes are producing basically allow the water, the seawater, to penetrate down into the crust and pick up heat and nutrients that then comes out at these black smoker systems and provides basically the food for these unusual systems. And so what's surprising is that on this, what's essentially a relatively barren seafloor in an environment that's hostile to life, really earthquakes are helping life thrive.
Well, I talked to Rajita about discovering new species. I'm assuming that when it comes to the area around these cracks, there are an awful lot of things that nobody has yet labeled, figured out.
Absolutely. I think they're constantly discovering new species. And there are the vast majority of our ocean floor is unexplored, and that's true of the ridge axis as well.
Back to you, Rajita, what is the interaction between the indigenous people in the area that you worked in, the Arunachal Pradesh? Mm-hmm. Is it hostile in the same way that Leela's experience has been in Kenya?
Yeah, in the sense that the region where I work in Arunachal Pradesh, there's about 26 different tribes, and most of them were shifting cultivators and hunter-gatherers before. And although now they're, coming into the mainstream and, it's very different now, but still hunting is a major way of life for most people, even people who are educated. And for various reasons, people hunt. So it's not a simple thing that they're just hunting for food or, it's a complex issue. So hunting is one of the major threats in that region, and it's definitely been wiping out species and causing, empty forests in many of the areas there.
So it must be a surprise to discover that there are some deer that nobody knew about, especially since people like to eat deer.
Yes, and in fact, but the funny thing is that the knowledge about this deer and the monkey is also from the local people. Like we as scientists, we bring it out for the public, but they're the ones who knew about it. It's just that no scientist had gone in, you know, but they knew about it and they told us about it. So in fact, the Arunachal macaque, I mean, if I may tell you, we named it in honor of the tribe that lives in that area who already had a name for that monkey.
Do they present some kind of a threat to the local livestock in the same way that the lions do in Kenya?
No.
Are they dangerous at all? Because it's sometimes interaction...
The monkeys?
With chimps, for example, can be loving and they also can be very dangerous.
Yeah, there is conflict with people for the monkeys because this part of Arunachal is a little different. The tribes here are Buddhist. But most of Arunachal, there's hardly any carnivore conflict because people anyway wipe out or they kill the species, so they wouldn't even tolerate any. And people don't really keep livestock in the other parts of Arunachal. They keep one semi-domesticated wild bison.
Mm-hmm.
A bison, which is a resource for many of the communities. But in this western part where the monkeys are, the tribes are Buddhist and they keep livestock. But with the monkeys, what happens is there is some conflict with crop damage. But because even here, although they are Buddhist, they also retaliate by killing. Chase them off. So
the big problem seems to be that people keep on moving into areas that once there were no humans living in. So
right.
And they wind up coming in conflict with the natural habitat.
Mm-hmm.
Inhabitants. So that's what's happening here as well?
Yes.
Are the macaques in danger of extinction?
The macaques, I don't think they're in danger of extinction. They are actually in many places in this part of Arunachal because of the Buddhist tribe, although there is retaliatory killing to a lesser extent than in other parts. And actually, it's funny, even though it's a new species and nobody had noticed them before, they actually thrive in the matrix of agriculture and the forest ecosystem. So you see them near crop fields quite a bit. But actually, my work is not so much with the macaque at all. You know, we just found the species, but after that, some of my other colleagues are working on the macaques. I work in a different area with other species, really.
And we'll get to that
in
a moment. We have to take a little break. My guests are Aparajita Datta, also Lila Hazar, and Maya Tolstoy, three of the five women who are being honored for their pioneering discoveries at the 7th Annual Women of Discovery Awards tonight. We'll be back with more right after this. Tonight, five female scientists are being honored for their pioneering discoveries at the 7th Annual Women of Discovery Awards. And joining me now are three of them, wildlife biologist Aparajita. I'm so sorry. You know, I really got your name right before. Aparajita Datta of India, wildlife conservationist Lila Hazar of Egypt, and New York's own marine geophysicist Maya Tolstoy. Welcome to all of you, and congratulations for the award. Aparajita, what's the discovery that you're being honored for?
The discovery was in terms of two new species that we found in these forests in India, in the northeastern part of India. I guess that would be considered a discovery, but I think it's for the larger work where I also work with communities to try to address some serious threats in that area. So I don't know whether it's for a particular discovery as such, but in terms of something sounding very exciting, it is probably the new species that we found in the area.
Well, looking over all of your work, there's that interaction. There's the scientific side, and then there is the dealing with the people who are in the area side. You found two species, new species of deer and also macaque monkeys?
Yeah.
Just coincidentally that you found the deer and the monkey? There's no relationship between the two?
No, there's no relationship. The monkey we found in another part of that area. The deer is actually, I need to correct that, the deer is not something that I found which is new. The monkey is new to science along with some other colleagues of mine. But the deer is already being discovered by Alan Rabinowitz, who works with WCS in New York, in the Myanmar forests. I just happened to find them in India.
Nobody knew that they were there.
Yeah, so for India, it's a big thing that there's another mammal added to the list, but it's just a range extension in real terms.
Different from a similar species of macaque monkeys are these? What is it, Arunachal monkeys?
Yeah, it's called the Arunachal macaque, and very surprisingly, this part of the region which I'm talking about is very poorly populated, but this part is pretty developed in some ways. And when my colleagues and I went on the survey, we were driving down, and it has road network, unlike many other places in that region. And we were amazed to see this troop of macaques, which looked very dark and bulky, like gorillas almost, the way they were walking. And we knew that there's another macaque that's supposed to be found in the area, and it did not look anything like that. So it was quite amazing that people had missed it.
And how genetically different are they from other macaques?
Genetically, my colleagues have done more further DNA analysis, and they're quite different. But they're related to the closest, the existing sympatric species, which is the Assamese macaque.
But they can't interbreed?
They could be interbreeding, yeah.
Leila, tell us about the initiative for which you're being recognized.
The initiative that we're working on is a project called Lion Guardians. And basically, the situation in Kenya is very tough with lions. Lions are disappearing from one of their last strongholds at a very alarming rate. About 50 years ago, we had 500,000 lions in all of Africa. And
these
now,
are the classic African lions?
These are the classic African lions, and now we have probably less than 29,000 left on the whole continent.
Wow.
And I think people don't really realize that. And the main cause for their decline is conflict with pastoralists, with livestock farmers. Carnivores eat people's livestock and people retaliate. And we're working in an area in southern Kenya called Maselent with the Maasai tribe. And they completely rely on livestock. Their livelihood is based around livestock. And when carnivores do eat their livestock, they have almost no choice but to retaliate. And so as a conservationist, we try to provide incentives and opportunities for them to engage in conservation. And Lion Guardians does that. It's a program that that tries to integrate and involve communities in conservation by working specifically with the age group called warriors. They're called Moran warriors, and they're the ones who are responsible for killing lions. And we take them on to the project and teach them about conservation. And now we have Morans across the ecosystem who are actually doing conservation and monitoring the lions instead of killing them.
Have lions always? We're talking about the Maasai, who mostly herd cattle.
Of course.
Have they always been a danger to the livestock, or are they going after the livestock because other things that they would have fed on in the past are no longer around?
I guess it probably is a mixture of both. Maasai have always killed lions. It's been in their tradition. They had, especially the younger age set, they go on a manhood hunt when they're very young. And, about 8 to 10 morons, they go out to kill a lion. And the first one to spear the lion is said to be given, their birth name is dropped, and they're given the name of the lion that they killed. And they're fawned by all the women in the community. And it's probably the most important day for a Moran's life. And so the relationship between lions and Maasai are extremely close, but I think in the past there were just a lot more lions. And of course they did kill livestock, but it was maybe more sustainable back then, but now with such few lions, we're actually able to see the results.
You said there are 29,000 lions in Kenya.
No, in all of Africa. In all of Africa.
Was Kenya the main repository?
East Africa and Southern Africa. About half of those 29,000 lions live in Tanzania. And we estimate about 2,000 lions live in Kenya. And about half of those 2,000 lions live in the southern part of Kenya where we work.
Maya, what about the research for which you're being awarded?
I work on mid-ocean ridges, which are the chain of seafloor volcanoes where all of the oceanic crust is formed. So it's where two-thirds of the surface of our planet forms. And I specifically work on the little micro-earthquakes that are constantly happening there and on the eruptions that occur on the seafloor.
And that's in the middle of the Atlantic? And
There's one in the middle of the Atlantic. There's one on toward the center, but in the eastern part of the Pacific. There's one just off the coast of Oregon and Washington. There are mid-ocean ridges in all the major oceans in the world.
And it means that it's expanding the size of the oceans in every case?
The oceans are constantly spreading at these ridge sites. They're constantly moving apart, and then the crust is ultimately subducted. Again, it's subduction zones, so that the planet's not getting bigger, but new surface is constantly being formed.
How do the tidal cycles affect seismic activity underwater?
Well, one of the things that we've found with the little micro-earthquakes is that they're heavily influenced by the ocean tides. So the additional loading and unloading that you get with the water as the tides go up and down cause these little cracks to happen, preferentially when the stresses are greater for inducing cracks. But one of the most exciting things we're finding is that the micro-earthquakes actually are essential for fueling these very unusual hydrothermal ecosystems that live there. So there are creatures there that live chemosynthetically, so without sunlight. And it turns out that they're very dependent on earthquakes because the cracks that the earthquakes are producing basically allow the water, the seawater, to penetrate down into the crust and pick up heat and nutrients that then comes out at these black smoker systems and provides basically the food for these unusual systems. And so what's surprising is that on this, what's essentially a relatively barren seafloor in an environment that's hostile to life, really earthquakes are helping life thrive.
Well, I talked to Rajita about discovering new species. I'm assuming that when it comes to the area around these cracks, there are an awful lot of things that nobody has yet labeled, figured out.
Absolutely. I think they're constantly discovering new species. And there are the vast majority of our ocean floor is unexplored, and that's true of the ridge axis as well.
Back to you, Rajita, what is the interaction between the indigenous people in the area that you worked in, the Arunachal Pradesh? Mm-hmm. Is it hostile in the same way that Leela's experience has been in Kenya?
Yeah, in the sense that the region where I work in Arunachal Pradesh, there's about 26 different tribes, and most of them were shifting cultivators and hunter-gatherers before. And although now they're, coming into the mainstream and, it's very different now, but still hunting is a major way of life for most people, even people who are educated. And for various reasons, people hunt. So it's not a simple thing that they're just hunting for food or, it's a complex issue. So hunting is one of the major threats in that region, and it's definitely been wiping out species and causing, empty forests in many of the areas there.
So it must be a surprise to discover that there are some deer that nobody knew about, especially since people like to eat deer.
Yes, and in fact, but the funny thing is that the knowledge about this deer and the monkey is also from the local people. Like we as scientists, we bring it out for the public, but they're the ones who knew about it. It's just that no scientist had gone in, but they knew about it and they told us about it. So in fact, the Arunachal macaque, if I may tell you, we named it in honor of the tribe that lives in that area who already had a name for that monkey.
Do they present some kind of a threat to local livestock in the same way that the lions do in Kenya?
No.
Are they dangerous at all? Because it's sometimes interaction...
The monkeys?
With chimps, for example, but the monkeys, can be loving, and
fact,
they also can be very dangerous.
Yeah, there is conflict with people for the monkeys because this part of Arunachal is a little different. The tribes here are Buddhist. But most of Arunachal, there's hardly any carnivore conflict because people anyway wipe out or they kill the species, so they wouldn't even tolerate any. And people don't really keep livestock in the other parts of Arunachal. They keep one semi-domesticated wild bison, a bison, which is a resource for many of the communities. But in this western part where the monkeys are, the tribes are Buddhist and they keep livestock. But with the monkeys, what happens is there is some conflict with crop damage. But because even here, although they are Buddhist, they also retaliate by killing. So, or they, chase them off. So
the big problem seems to be that people keep on moving into areas that once there were no humans living in. So
right.
and they wind up coming in conflict with the natural habitat inhabitants. So that's what's happening here as well.
Yes.
Are the macaques in danger of extinction?
The macaques, I don't think they're in danger of extinction. They are actually in many places in this part of Arunachal because of the Buddhist tribe, although there is retaliatory killing to a, to a lesser extent than in other parts. And actually, it's funny, even though it's a new species and nobody had noticed them before, they actually thrive in the matrix of agriculture and the forest ecosystem. So you see them near crop fields quite a bit. But actually, my work is not so much with the macaque at all. You know, we just found the species, but after that, some of my other colleagues are working on the macaques. I work in a different area with other species, really.
And we'll get to that in a moment. We have to take a little break. My guests are Aparajita Datta, also Lila Hazza, and Maya Tolstoy, three of the five women who are being honored for their pioneering discoveries at the 7th Annual Women of Discovery Awards tonight. We'll be back with more right after this. The H.G. Wells drama The Invisible Man will get a whole new look and sound tomorrow in WNYC's Green Space. Come in here, a modern reimagining of the classic starring Peter Garrity with music performed live by Michael Reisman, director of the Philip Glass Ensemble. Purchase tickets now at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. This is WNYC and wnyc.org.
WNYC receives support from the New York Philharmonic, presenting Dvorak's Saint-Saëns and Martinu with conductor Alan Gilbert and violinist Joshua Bell, April 30th through May 5th at Avery Fisher Hall, 212-875-5656 or nyphil.org. MetLife Foundation, sponsor of the Jerome L. Green Performance Spaces presentation of The Invisible Man, Wednesday, April 29th. Info at wnyc.org/thegreenspace. Thornton Wilder's Our Town, directed by David Cromer, now playing at the Barrow Street Theater. Tickets at smarttix.com or 212-868-4444.
Bob Dylan's latest album is out today and reviews are divided. It's either the latest chapter in a late career renaissance or a sign that his best work is behind him. Today, a soundcheck smackdown debate on 60s Dylan versus today's Dylan. That's coming up at 2 and 93.9 FM, WNYC. We're back with three of the five winners of the 7th Annual Women of Discovery Awards. My guests are Lila Hazza of Egypt, marine geophysicist. She's a wildlife conservationist. Sorry. I'm starting to sound like I talked about Ed Sullivan earlier and how he mangled words, and I guess I'm inspired by him and hoping that I get my own television variety show, so I'm doing the same thing here. Marine geophysicist Maya Tolstoy and also wildlife biologist Aparajita Datta of India. Let's talk a bit about further about the Maasai, Lila. See, I did it again. How do you get people who have dealt with their environment in a certain way for many generations, for centuries, to break that tradition, convince them not to kill lions?
Well, that's a very good question. We actually don't try to convince them not to kill. What we try to do is give them alternatives. So the Lion Guardian program actually uses their traditions and their cultures, which specific values of their cultures, and we embed that within the program. So we don't disregard the culture or try to change their traditions. We use those as a way to actually promote the project. And therefore, when they're actually working as a Lion Guardian, we're not really teaching them. They're teaching us a lot about conservation because they are conservationists traditionally. And we're trying to hone on those specific values that are pro-environmental values. And the traditional lion killing hunts that they do, they don't go on them very often anymore. It's more those retaliatory killings we're trying to avoid. And we do that by trying to actually reduce conflict from happening, so they don't have to go out and retaliate.
So you try to keep the lions away from their cattle?
Not necessarily, or keep the livestock away from the lions. It's hard to do it the other way around. But trying to once we know where lions are, we the lion guardians then tell the other livestock herders to avoid certain specific, we call them hotspot areas, where conflict can be very high. And when people tend to avoid those areas and to not lose livestock in the field, but can actually bring them all back home safely, and we reinforce the livestock corrals, so livestock or so carnivores can't enter at night, those are all different ways that we try to mitigate conflict from happening, and then people will not go out and retaliate.
Well, you said there, how many lions? 29,000 in all of Africa now?
Yeah.
Does that mean they're in danger of extinction?
Soon enough. We think that within 5 or 10 years, there probably will be no lions left in Kenya.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And that's because at a certain point, even the gene pool becomes a problem? I've been reading about other species like leopards, where there are just too few leopards to actually sustain any kind of a future for the species.
I think specifically with cheetahs more than any other carnivore, their gene pool is probably already ruined.
Oh, cheetahs.
Cheetahs are they're having a lot of problems with that. With lions, we're not at that point right now. There's lions move a lot, which, you know, we have lions moving from Tanzania into Kenya. Also, lions, they can move 40 kilometers a day. So breeding is not, and also lions populate very quickly. They just need to have the opportunity to do it and a safe place to stay. And the problem that, you know, you were talking to Aparajita about population growth and not having enough habitat left, that's a big problem in Kenya as well. There's too many people and there's not enough there's not enough safe places to live anymore.
But aren't there game preserves?
There are, but they're quite small. The ones that are, I guess between 70% and 80% of all wildlife in Kenya live outside of the national park. So people and wildlife are forced to coexist. And as conservationists, what we try to do is find sustainable ways to do that.
Maya, how do you get down to the deepest parts of the ocean bottom?
Well, most of the time for my work, I don't actually have to go down there myself. I send my instruments down. So we go out on research ships, and the instruments I use are called ocean bottom seismometers, and they're just craned over the side of the ship, and then they free fall down to the seafloor. And that takes about 45 minutes to an hour, depending on the water depth, obviously. And then it sits there and records for up to a year. And then we'll come back and send a coded acoustic pulse to the instrument to tell it to release its anchor. And it will float back up, and we'll recover it on the surface and get the data there.
And what is it recording? Just the seismic
activity?
It's recording
recording seismic activity, exactly. It's like a land seismometer, but just packaged to work on the seafloor and to withstand the extreme pressures and work in fairly cold temperatures.
Are these the deepest parts of the ocean?
These are actually not the deepest parts because they're at the ridge axis, which tends to be slightly higher. It's a volcanic system. The deepest parts are in the trenches at the other end when the crust has gotten very cold, and so it's sinking more into the mantle.
But since no one goes down there, then we really can't know much about the creatures live around this ridge.
Well, people do actually go down in submarines. I've been down in a submarine before, these little three-person submarines. And it's
good if you're not claustrophobic.
Yeah, good if you're not claustrophobic, exactly. It's really exciting to go down there. And for me, it was really an adventure to get to see this area that I've been studying for years up close. But biologists go down there, fluid chemists go down there, geologists often go down to take samples and to take as well as pictures.
And when they're captured and brought back up to the surface, I guess they're brought back in some water so that they can survive. What is it like for them? Because they're in a different pressure area.
Well, most of them don't survive. There is one group that brings up tube worms and keeps them in pressurized cases on land, but no, most of them will not survive when they come up.
It's the opposite of our bodies. We can't survive in the pressure below, and they can't survive in the light pressure above.
Yes. And they're living on sulfur, basically, so it's an environment that we would find very hostile.
Aparajita, can you describe the Indian rainforest for us? Are there more than one rainforest in India?
The main rainforest areas in India are in the southern part, one region called the Western Ghats, which is near the western coast. And that is one of the global biodiversity hotspots. India, despite its billion-plus people, we have four of such hotspots. And the other rainforests are in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, which is on the eastern side. It's, you know, in the Bay of Bengal, close to the Burma. And the other rainforests are where I work, in Arunachal Pradesh and the northeastern part. But all of the northeast is not rainforest. So so you have dipterocarp species, but it's very poor in dipterocarp species, which are, like, in Southeast Asia, you have lots and lots of dipterocarp. These are these tall emergent trees, which are very important as timber species. So they're
being cut down. So are the Indian rainforests as endangered as the Amazon seems to be?
Oh, yes. The pressures are a lot related to not just logging, but more, expansion of agriculture and settlements. And although India has very, very strong wildlife laws, more than, I think, many other countries in Asia, a lot of that is on paper, because enforcement is often difficult, given some political, reasons. And like in the Northeast, a lot of the deforestation in the last 10 years has been because of insurgency, militant groups that are taking over certain areas for their own, hill councils. And so the
various Maoist groups, for example.
Not Maoist groups. These are different, a tribe who in Assam who want to lay claim to a certain part of the area because they see themselves as the original people, and they're fighting against the state of Assam. So, I mean, the law enforcement authorities, the forest department, they just turn a blind eye in many cases. In many cases, it's difficult for them also to implement.
I saw a Sajajit Ray film about indigenous people in one of the rainforests. I didn't even realize that India had groups that weren't part of the regular population. Do they function within this area? Do we see similar things from them that we see in Kenya or in South America?
It's only most of India, even in the central part of India, you have tribes, like in the southern part. But those tribes, because they are in the mainland, they are, little pockets within the mainstream. And they're really marginalized people, They culturally also have been really suppressed. And so their sense of value or worth is very poor. But the Northeast is very different. The Northeast is completely, largely dominated by tribes. And there's some 7 states, and all of them have different tribes with hundreds of languages and, very different. There, because of government policies since the British, to sort of let them be, and Jawaharlal Nehru's time, from then they had a very good policy of trying to keep off non-tribals entering into the area and changing the area too fast. So therefore, they really have a good sense of self-worth, and they're very different. Yes, they're culturally much more similar to Southeast Asian people, and they have Mongoloid features. Shifting cultivation is very important. They have animistic traditions, although largely a lot of places people are converting to Christianity.
Rather than becoming Hindus or Buddhists or Muslims.
Buddhist tribes are there in certain areas, and the Buddhism is of 2 kinds, the Mahayana and the other kind,
So. Now, your work has led to the declaration of a biosphere reserve in the area, but you suggest that that is just on paper?
Yeah, the biosphere reserve, by the way, is in western Arunachal, where I don't really work that much. That was one of the surveys we did where we found the macaque. A biosphere reserve has no legal status. That's just one of these large designations to get more funding for an area and to, help protection and, sort of get research and other stuff done. What has legal backing is a national park and wildlife sanctuary. So I work in but even the national parks and sanctuaries in many cases are just paper parks.
Lila, you are from Egypt, but you have an American accent. Where did you study science?
I was actually born in Washington, D.C., but both of my parents are Egyptian, and I used to spend a lot of time in my childhood in Egypt. So, but I studied in the U.S., and I'm currently getting my Ph.D. at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
But then when you decided to do your scientific work, you went to a different part of Africa.
I started my work in Tanzania, and I was there for 5 years. I was working with elephants, and I was also working for a community conservation program that's connected with a hunting company, which was really interesting because most of Western Tanzania. I mean, it's a vast country, and a lot of it still has pristine bush there. And hunting companies own huge chunks of land, like a million acres per se. And there are communities that live around these hunting blocks. And I was really hoping that to encourage them to do conservation with the communities rather than bringing in outside people.
Are there any areas in Egypt that might also require this kind of conservation work?
Unfortunately, no. There's very little wildlife left in Egypt.
That's because the country, the civilization is so old, and part of the civilization is that we wipe out all the species that aren't human.
Also, there was a lot of hunting in Egypt. My father often tells stories of hearing lions roaring at night when he was young in the desert, and wolves, and there were cheetah in the desert. But nowadays, there's nothing. There's a lot of hunters coming from the Middle East that would come in and basically hunted everything in Egypt. Wildlife laws, conservation laws, just they didn't exist in Egypt. And unfortunately, as much as I'd like to work there, there's not a lot of work for me to do there.
Maya, how many women are in your field of science?
Well, there's a few. There's increasing numbers.
Because the question we hear again and again is, why do you think there are so few female American scientists, considering the fact that we'd like to believe that our academic institutions have become enlightened in recent years?
Yes, we would like to believe that. I think that it's improving. There's still obviously a problem. When you look at the pipeline, there are far more women students than there are at the more senior levels. I think that there's obviously still some issues with discrimination in academia, but it's getting better.
Is it also difficult to challenge to be both a scientist and a mother?
It can be. I mean, there are definitely issues associated with that. But I think, when you choose to be a parent, you also choose to make sacrifices no matter what you're doing. And at some level, I found it harder to do field work with my son. I wanted to stay home more, but I've also been able to write more papers because I'm not traveling as much. Mm-hmm. So,
Aparajita, you have written children's books, haven't you?
Yeah.
So that's another way to maintain some kind of contact with your kids?
I actually never had kids, but I just had a kid. I just had a kid 2 months ago. In fact, we've come here with the baby. it's 2 months old.
is this a concern for you as well, Lila?
The concern of
being a woman in a male-dominated field,
and especially working in Africa, because the women are definitely second class in Africa, and trying to. I employ only men, and so I have 40 men working for me. And but there is still a respect, and I think that's something that you have to work for. You don't automatically get it because of your gender, but I think when one works for it, you do get it, and they do respect you once you show what you're able to do.
Well, congratulations to all three of you, three of the five women who will be given Women of Discovery Awards in the 7th Annual Awards Ceremony. I've been talking with Lila Hazza, Maya Tolstoy, and Aparajita Datta. It's been a real pleasure having you here. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I guess it feels good to be recognized for all the work that you've done.
Absolutely.
On tomorrow's show, New York Times business columnist Ron Lieber fields your questions on how to survive in the current economic climate. Then Gourmet magazine editor-in-chief Ruth Reichels reassesses her relationship with her mother, and Colson Whitehead on his autobiographical fourth novel, Sad Harbor. Plus, psychiatrist and writer Nawal El-Sadawi on the status of women in the Arab world. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Jennifer Janish, Tess Hartman, Angela Sheldon, and Barbara Kahn. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. We will see you tomorrow.